warrior who protects his people from monstrous giants. He was the idol of Vikings and barbarians in the darkest age ever known to man. But few know the reality behind his myth. He battled the ancient world's most colossal sea monster. And he was the last hope for Europe's pagans as they defied the armies of Christendom. Fact and fiction collide in the myth of the mighty Thor. Two arch enemies battle to the death. Thor, the thunder god, against a staggering beast. A giant snake who strikes with lethal force. It is man versus monster. Thor unleashes his deadliest weapon, lightning from his magic hammer, as thunder rocks heaven and earth. The myth of Thor is filled with these epic showdowns, heroic battles against creatures who threaten mankind.
Thor is the champion of the gods. He's the great fighter who can be brought out when something is really bad. You don't go to Thor for wisdom. Go to Thor because he's going to protect you against the evil monsters.
Tales of Thor's adventures provided escape from one of the bleakest periods in human history, the Dark Ages of the first millennium AD. It was a time when the Norse world, stretching from the British Isles to the Baltic Sea, was in turmoil.
It's an agricultural society where people were farming and surviving kind of at the very edge of how it was possible to survive because it was cold. It was the northern part of Europe. It wasn't around the Mediterranean where it was much easier to grow things. And it tended to be, from everything we can tell, quite violent.
War, famine, and death were daily facts of life on the desolate northern fringes of Europe. But the myth of Thor brought a sense of order to the chaos.
It was a religion of the countryside. Paganism actually is a Latin word that describes that, what the country people believe in. And paganism is not really well organized either. It's not like the Greek pantheon in the sense that it's very well organized and everybody knows whose responsibilities and who's more important than whom. It's very different.
The view of human life in that mythology was a fairly dark, a fairly stern one. Human beings didn't look forward to the kind of salvation in heaven at the end of time that's promised in the Christian stories. They had a kind of a darker, a more sorrowful view of life. People have to show great courage and hardiness in the face of enormous obstacles.
For inspiration, the people looked to Thor.
I'm a white nationalist. The government has not now nor ever will crush white nationalism.
It's easy to spot a stormtrooper walking down the street in uniform and say, well, that's a Nazi. I can recognize him. It's much harder to picture the people who seem very much like ourselves.
I think many things that Hitler did were great. And many of those things were adopted by Franklin D. Roosevelt. I think the idea of the Waffen-SS, that was a good idea. This is for life and death.
Declaration of War, November 25th, 1984. It is a dark and dismal time in the history of our race. An evil shadow has fallen across our once fair land. A certain vile, alien people have taken control of our country. When the day comes, we will not ask whether you swung to the right or whether you swung to the left. we will simply swing you by the neck. This is war.
The right-wing sect which declared war on the United States government in 1984 had many names. The Bruderschweigen, German for Solid Brotherhood, the White American Bastion, and the Order. Former members revealed that a special order assassination squad plotted to kill the heads of three commercial television networks, former Secretary of State Henry Kissinger, and television producer Norman Lear, among others. The unquestioned leader of the order was Bob Matthews, a well-liked lumberjack from upstate Washington. After more than a year of tracking Matthews, FBI agents surrounded him in an island hideout near Seattle. During a shootout on December 6, 1984, the house caught fire. When it was over, Matthews was dead. After the fire, FBI agents launched a nationwide manhunt for Matthews' followers.
In spite of Matthews' death and the arrests of his supporters, agitation persists for a militant, separate, Aryan nation. Order members say that the war has just begun.
Bob, you're really one hell of a man. And imagine a man that would die for his beliefs. There's very few men like that today.
Bruce Carroll Pierce was the FBI's most wanted man until his arrest. He was also the order's second in command.
Just because Bob died or we've had some deaths in the past or had some setbacks, I don't believe by any means that the movement is over or that our goals will not be accomplished.
The order was a secret army striking out at a federal government that was vulnerable to armed attack.
Government's weak. Government is pathetically weak. This government is so weak right now that if 5,000 men of any race, of any consequence, any type of philosophical fundamentalism stood up, told the federal government that we have 5,000 men who would die right now, for what we believe in, the government can do nothing about it.
People are surprised at what's going on, and I think it's a situation you have to report. Guys like Matthews and others declared war on what they call the ZOG, the Zionist Occupational Government. When that happened, you saw the Fed begin to scramble.
It was the robbery of a Brinks truck in Ukiah, California in July 1984 when the order made off with $3.6 million that drew the FBI's full attention. At the same time, Secret Service agents caught several members trying to pass counterfeit bills. After his arrest, a friend became a government informant.
I believe that those men are prisoners of war. And I would support them as prisoners of war.
Tom Metzger is one of the most popular leaders on the ultra-right. While media attention was fixed on the trial of order members in Seattle, from his home and headquarters in Fallbrook, California, an hour's drive from San Diego, Metzger continued to recruit for his organization, WAR.
This is a time of rapid communications, and we must be on the cutting edge of technology like anyone else. We like it because it reaches into maybe every home in the United States where there's a computer. Every young person that is into computers, and there are millions across the United States, and they tend to be sharp kids with these computers in their bedroom, and they can log on and get all this information.
To attract others to his program, Metzger also set up 24-hour telephone hotlines in 8 cities, including Los Angeles, Sacramento, and San Francisco.
Why are the Jews and their supporters so afraid of free speech that they try to terrorize their critics into silence?
Metzger also has a television talk show aired on Community Access Cable Television.
Reason that show dedicated to free speech.
When FBI agents moved in on the order, members were within a few weeks of cracking Brink Central Vault here in San Francisco. With more than $30 million, they could have bought and outfitted an army.
I need my own state. I need my own nation. I need to have my own schools for my daughter, for my son, for my family.
When Nero tried to persecute the Christians in the Roman times, it did not eradicate them. And I do not believe it will eradicate us.
Just a few will be enough to reignite the spark for us to rise again. It's not over by any means. It's just a start.
We enjoin all people to choose intelligently which side they will be on. Make sure that you have the greatest number of relevant facts possible. There will surely come a day when fence sitting will be impossible. And once you you have made up your mind and begin to act, the die is cast for you. There will be no turning back. With these things said, let the battle begin.
Yeah, where and when is that spark going to come again? It will come again. And it'll be just enough. Just enough. Well, it's Terrible Tommy here in the bunker, and it's the first of June 2017. Take note on the email of the new address. We've changed again. So make sure you address everything to the new address. And the old address is still good. We're going to keep that for a while, so you don't have to worry. If you've already sent something into the old address, we're going to get it. But try to put it to the new address now. Now I'll give it to you again. P.O. Box 1687. And the post office address is 315 East Esplanade, that's Esplanade Avenue, and that's San Jacinto, California, 92581. So if you got that, I hope you got that, and away we go. There was nobody chased us out of the other box, it's just that box was too far away from my location. Cost too much gas. I don't want to spend your donations on gas to go clear across town. I don't know whether the Great White Father has announced his position on global warming or yet or not, or what he's going to do about the Paris Treaty. That's an interesting controversy. There's good points on both sides as far as I'm concerned. I do know that we need to do as much as possible to keep the environment straight and the water straight and the air straight and everything, because that's what white people need. Yeah. We can't allow ourselves to get in these heated debates and arguments and fights over politics when it comes to the environment. It's got to be whatever is good for the white environment is good, and what is bad for the white environment is bad. Can't be according to Republican or Democrat or socialist or communist or fascist or national socialist or whatever. But with the world population soaring and nobody seeming to have much of an answer to that, except keep it in your pants, we've got to understand that maybe that's a good thing, global warming, because it's going to mean the elimination of millions of third world non-whites. And of course the scum of the earth normally live around the coast. Sorry any of our buddies that live around the coast, but perfectly honest, it seems like many of the worst forms of humanity gather around the coasts of countries and islands. What's going to happen down in the Philippines? The old ISIS, they're invading the Philippines now. It's going to be an interesting situation between them and that president down there of the Philippines, who's doing the right thing and putting a bullet in the head of all the drug pushers and so forth. So if he's got the balls to do that, he's got the balls to clean out his ISIS, and in no uncertain terms, one in the head, one in the heart. Let's see him do it. There's a scam that the government's pulling on people. A whistleblower and former CEO of a cancer detection laboratory, Michael J. Doherty, detailed how in 2010 his business, LABMD, faced extortion from a cybersecurity company named Taversa, which told him there'd been a security breach in his patient files. But according to a former Taversa employee, it was Taversa itself that hacked into the lab MD, trying to force them to hiring them to fix the breach. When Doherty refused to comply, Diversa reported LABMD to the Federal Trade Commission about the so-called breach, and the FTC ended up taking Daugherty to court over the issue, and they've been fighting ever since. But it was this Diversa was connected to the government shaking down private business people. And they've done it all over the country and maybe even all over the world. Welcome to the month named after the Roman goddess Juno. On this day in 1831, white Aryan British explorer James Clark Ross discovered the North Magnetic Pole. However, this location gradually moves over time. It is currently drifting away from North America towards Siberia. On June 1, 1843, it snowed in Buffalo, Rochester, and Cleveland. How about that for an update? Well, I'm going to read to you from an article written by one of our old comrades from the way back, even in the streets. I'm not going to tell you his name because he's very well situated at the moment. High security with no problems, so we're not going to do like the right wing does and expose everybody. Yeah. Trump made an arms deal with Saudi Arabia for $110 billion. House of Saud will pay this in U.S. dollars. These are U.S. dollars the House of Saud has made from its oil customers, which is the only acceptable form of payment worldwide for oil products. World War II established the U.S. dollar as the world reserve currency and the only way nations could buy or sell oil. They would have to exchange goods and services for U.S. dollars to purchase oil products or face sanctions. Or if that did not work, then face military might. This was established during the Bretton Woods Conference on July 1944. It was also the birth of the IMF. The U.S. became the most powerful country in the world by this measure and thereby could strangle anyone it pleased. The U.S. dollar is no longer backed by gold since 1974 and Richard Nixon. It is backed by the petrodollar, but also can be considered the aircraft carrier dollar. If you defer to another currency to buy or sell oil, you will have an aircraft carrier off your coast. After crippling sanctions, Saddam Hussein started accepting the euro for oil in 2000. Libya's Gaddafi started the African dinar, which was a gold currency meant for a Central African bank in 2011, but he was bombed out of existence before it took hold. Now look at Iraq and Libya. The weapons deal Trump did is simply a bribe to keep the House of Saud from establishing the petrodollar and also giving it military hegemony over the other OPEC nations to make them follow suit. The Federal Reserve is desperate to counteract the failing United States economy and its demise. It cannot print money fast enough to prop this system up. Don't forget that when all these U.S. dollars come back to the United States, when they are no longer the reserve currency, the dollar loses its value, inflation is immediate, and a collapse is right behind. Russia and China have struck a deal whereas Russia will accept the yuan instead of U.S. dollars for its oil and gas. This bold move to fight back after the United States sanctions against Russia. Did you wonder why the media is slandering Russia and often China all day, every day? All American media is owned by only five companies, all with ties to the others through banks. Did you wonder why every NATO cannon in Europe is pointed at Russia? A similar bribe was given to Iran a few years ago when it came to light that Barack Obama sent hundreds of millions of cash dollars to Iran, as Iran had lost its petrodollars after the U.S. sanctions. Iran threatened to allow the purchase of its oil in euros. It had no other choice. Neither did the U.S. They cannot afford war with Iran. This did not work out entirely, and Iran now accepts the yuan and the ruble for its oil. Iran also sought nuclear power so it could hold its oil and its reserves for sale, rather than burn it away keeping the lights on. Iran does not want a nuclear weapon. Iran has not attacked another nation in over 200 years. Iran knows it would be obliterated in 5 minutes if so much as sneezed. These are the facts. Well, thank you, my friend and comrade. You've been a long and good person and supported our program all the way along for a long, long time. And I hope you keep contributing to the show. Poor LeBron James, the basketball player. He is terribly upset. I told you yesterday somebody spray-painted nigger on his front door, his front gate. It's going around the world. He's getting millions of dollars in publicity off of this thing. But where is the publicity about the six-year-old black kid that was killed by two black teenagers down in Mississippi? Didn't say nothing about that, man.
In front of my boys right now, and I won't be home until next week. So this is kind of killing me inside right now.
And out of news of another unfortunate sign that we still have a long way to go. LeBron James, one of the most famous people in the world, today became another very public victim of racism. A racial slur found in his Los Angeles home is being investigated tonight. Channel 3's Hillary Golston has that story and takes a look at the state of hate in America.
The gate may be painted over, but it's hard to forget. That word on the gate of LeBron's home has gotten a lot of attention, of course, not just because the incident is being investigated as a hate crime, but because James is a millionaire, a superstar, an athlete. The reality is no one is exempt from hate. But we also have to keep in mind that for nearly 6,000 people, they too were the victims of hate crimes in 2015. LeBron James, a world champion, one of the greatest in the game. But that status can't keep him from something, unfortunately, all too common. Hate.
No matter how famous you are, no matter how many people admire you, you know, being black in America is tough.
The N-word painted on the gate of his West L.A. home. After this morning's crime isn't the first time we've heard the king speak about social justice.
We all have to do better.
Like the ESPY stand he took with other basketball stars, making us think. The FBI collected nearly 6,000 incidents of hate in 2015, more than 7,000 victims. About 18% of victims targeted because of sexual orientation, followed by religious bias. But race, ethnicity, ancestry bias, that accounted for the overwhelming majority of these incidents, more than 59%.
If this incident that happened to me and my family today can keep the conversation going and can shed light on us trying to figure out a way to keep progressing and not regressing, then I'm not against it happen to us again.
2016 data from the FBI won't be available until sometime this year, but the Southern Poverty Law Center noted the number of hate groups has risen for a second straight year in a row in 2016. LeBron said he is going to be focused tomorrow as much as he can be, and it also reminds him that his family is most important.
Poor multi-million dollar basketball player. His great talent is to take a little ball and dribble it down the court and put it in a basket, which I never thought added anything to history or anything else. I guess who made him all that money? It was white money that made him that money. White coaches, Jews paid him, and the fans, most biggest share of them are white. Maybe two-thirds are white. So there he's crying because he's in trouble. He's got a big problem there with a hate crime, supposed hate crime. I guess it's not a hate crime, though, when the blacks murder blacks, huh? I guess not. They don't call that a hate crime, do they? It's sure not a love. Is it a love crime? How about that? This whole thing is so much bullshit, boys and girls. That story is probably going to last a week in the press around the world. A poor black boy, poor black millionaire. He don't have enough money to guard his house. Wasn't that the basketball player that was charged with raping a gal in a hotel a few years ago? Wasn't that the guy that he got out of that? I think it was a white woman, too, or maybe a Hispanic that he allegedly raped. How soon we forget. We can't put a basketball player, a nigger basketball player, in the clink. That would be bad press. What would people think about us around the world? You want to hear the real story about Noriega of Panama and what really happened? Well, I'm going to give it to you.
By Jonathan Marshall, the death of former Panamanian strongman Manuel Noriega on May 29 elicited few, if any, tears. But it should have sparked more reflection in the United States on his ugly history of service to the CIA, the hypocrisy of Washington's sudden discovery of his abuses once Noriega became an unreliable ally against the Nicaraguan Sandinistas, and the George H.W. Bush administration's bloody and illegal invasion of Panama in December 1989. Vice President George H.W. Bush meeting with Panamanian General Manuel Noriega in the mid-1980s, when Noriega was considered a key ally in helping the Nicaraguan Contras wage a brutal guerrilla war to overthrow the leftist Sandinista government. In fairness, many progressives and mainstream journalists have called attention to this troublesome history over the years. But few have dared to question the nearly universal condemnation of Noriega as a protector of international drug traffickers. That incendiary claim, first broadcast loudly by the unlikely trio of right-wing Senator Jesse Helms, R. North Carolina, Liberal Senator John Kerry, D. Massachusetts, and investigative journalist Seymour Hersh, galvanized the American public to support his ouster. After the U.S. invasion, which killed hundreds of Panamanians and 23 U.S. soldiers, Noriega was arrested on January 3, 1990 by armed U.S. drug agents. President George H.W. Bush declared that Noriega's apprehension and return to the United States should send a clear signal that the United States is serious in its determination that those charged with promoting the distribution of drugs cannot escape the scrutiny of justice. U.S. Ambassador Dean Hinton called the invasion the biggest drug bust in history. Convicted in 1992 on 8 felony counts following what officials called the trial of the century, Noriega was sentenced to 40 years in jail. Although released early from U.S. incarceration, he spent the rest of his life in French and Panamanian prisons. The resulting publicity created lasting myths about Noriega and drugs. Journalists who should know better have described Noriega as one of the world's biggest drug kingpins, to quote Time magazine. In fact, Lewis Kellner, the U.S. attorney who oversaw his Miami indictment and trial, admitted, Noriega was never a major player in the drug war. Indeed, at worst, he was a small fry compared to the military rulers of Honduras, whose epic protection of the cocaine trade was tolerated by Washington in return for using that country as a staging base for Contra operations against the Sandinista-led government of Nicaragua in the 1980s. Deeply flawed trial. A few close observers of the long, expensive, and controversial trial believe it failed to prove Noriega's guilt at all. Panamanian General Manuel Noriega is escorted onto a U.S. Air Force aircraft by agents from the U.S. Drug Enforcement Agency after his arrest in January 1990. U.S. military photo, David Adams, who covered it extensively for the London Independent, said the government's case was marred by incompetent witnesses, false testimony, and poor presentation. Newsday's Peter Eisner quoted Judge William Hovler, who presided over the trial, as saying the outcome could have been different if Noriega had been better represented. Although the government put more than 24 people on the stand, their testimony was not always relevant or credible. Paul Rothstein, Georgetown University law professor and former chairman of the American Bar Association's Criminal Evidence Committee, said of the government's witnesses, "What promised to be the trumpeting of elephants turned out to be the whimperings of mice." Big-time drug bosses enjoyed great rewards for telling the jury what the government wanted, observed reporter Glenn Garvin. To convict Noriega, the strike force had to make a flurry of deals with other accused narco-traffickers, bargaining a collective 1,435 years in prison down to 81. The fierce Noriega critic R.M. Costner declared, "The prosecution was shameless in its bribery of witnesses. What co-defendants got for flipping made me sometimes wish that I had been indicted." The proceedings were almost totally politicized. It was clear long before they opened that, regardless of evidence, Noriega could not possibly be acquitted, a very sad thing for the United States. Other witnesses who never took the stand contradicted the government's case years later. Retired Medellin cocaine lord Juan David Ochoa claimed in an interview with Frontline that at no moment did Noriega protect us. As far as I know, he had nothing to do with the drug trade. Greg Pasek, former head of financial operations for the DEA, said, "The Colombians I talked to in the drug transportation business said they didn't deal with Noriega at all. To deal with him, you would just have to pay him more money. They didn't need it. It would be expensive." In fact, DEA officials repeatedly lauded Noriega's cooperation with their anti-drug investigations, both in public letters of support and in private. Recalled Duane Claridge, former head of Latin America operations for the CIA, "The DEA had told us that they were getting great support in Panama, and from Noriega in particular, in interdicting drugs." More than a year after the U.S. invasion, when it was absolutely impolitic to voice such sentiments, one federal drug enforcement source told a reporter, "Noriega was helping us, not 10%, not 20% of the time, but in every instance we asked him to do so, 100% of the time." These were key operations that struck at both the Cali and Medellin cartels. Even the U.S. ambassador to Panama in the final years of Noriega's rule, Arthur H. Davis Jr., said in an oral history interview, "All I know is that, all the time I was there, Noriega cooperated 100% with our people. Anytime we had a ship that we wanted to be interdicted on the high seas and we asked permission, they gave permission. Anytime there was some prominent drug man coming up and we knew about it, Noriega would help us with it. And when we found out about things, the Panamanian Defense Forces would go over there and round them up and turn them over to us." Turning against Noriega, one of the high points of Noriega's cooperation was Operation Pisces, a 3-year undercover probe that culminated in 1987. Attorney General Edwin Meese called it nothing less than the largest and most successful undercover investigation in federal drug law enforcement history. Then Vice President George H.W. Bush with CIA Director William Casey at the White House on February 11, 1981. Photo credit, Reagan Library. Among those indicted were Medellin cartel kingpins Pablo Escobar and Fabio Ochoa. Panama made 40 arrests and seized $12 million from accounts in 18 local banks, said one U.S. prosecutor who helped direct the case. "The Panamanian officials we were dealing with were sincerely cooperative. They could have breached security, and they didn't. The operation may have pleased the DEA, but it angered the country's financial elite, who directly profited from money laundering." One local banker warned, "This could end the Panamanian banking system, because people will no longer believe they can count on bank secrecy." Within 2 months, spooked investors withdrew up to $4 billion of the country's $39 billion in bank deposits, triggering the most serious banking crisis in Panama's history. A Western diplomat said of Noriega, "The bankers can bring him down. They are complaining in Washington and they've got a lot of clout." The demonstrations organized that summer by Panama's business elite and Noriega's heavy-handed response to them triggered his eventual slide from power. The bankers were joined by angry cartel leaders, who viewed Noriega as an obstacle to the functioning of their money laundering operations in Panama, in the words of drug policy expert Renzel Early. A lawyer for the bosses of the Cali cartel complained that his clients were frustrated by the problems Noriega created for them in Panama. Cali leaders later got their revenge when they paid $1.25 million to bribe a drug trafficker to become a key witness against Noriega in his Miami trial. In exchange for the testimony, eager U.S. prosecutors agreed to cut 9 years off the sentence of an unrelated Cali trafficker brother of one of that cartel's senior leaders. When Noriega's defense team cried foul, a federal appeals court declined to order a new trial, but criticized the government for appearing to have treaded close to the line of willful blindness in its eagerness to win a conviction. Medellin leaders were just as unhappy with Noriega as those in Cali. A pilot for one of the biggest Medellin smugglers described Pablo Escobar's reaction after Noriega approved a raid on one of his cocaine labs in May 1984. "He was just really out of whack with Noriega. He was like, 'This guy is dead. No matter what, he is dead.' It would be foolish to assert that Noriega, alone among all leaders in Central America, kept his hands clean of drugs. But much of his personal fortune is easily accounted for from other sources, such as the sale of Panamanian passports on the black market. Whatever Noriega's involvement with drug traffickers, as I have shown elsewhere, the Bush administration displayed unbelievable cynicism when, even before his capture, it swore in a new president of Panama who had sat on the board of one of the most notorious drug money laundering banks in the country. His attorney general, who unfroze the bank accounts of Cali traffickers, later became legal counsel for the Cali cartel's top smuggler in Panama. Following Noriega's ouster, not surprisingly, cocaine trafficking began surging in the country. A year and a half after his arrest, unnamed U.S. experts told Time magazine that the unexpected result is that the rival Cali cartel established a base in Panama and has since inundated the country, along with Mexico, Guatemala, and the Caribbean, with vast quantities of cocaine destined for the U.S. and Europe. Today, though, all that is forgotten, along with the questionable course of justice during Noriega's trial. Noriega, even in death, deserves no eulogies, but he does deserve a more balanced judgment of history.
Well, that sort of gives you an idea of all the crooks. I mean, big-time crooks. Reagan, all the Bushes, Colonel North. What? He should have been in federal prison a long time ago. You can't escape it. That's what I keep trying to tell you, and I want to teach you. These people are all criminals. I mean, heavy-duty criminals, and if anybody gets in their way, they do them in, like they use Noriega. He wasn't near as bad as they made him look to be. And that's the way it goes. But white people have to understand, white working people have to understand what you're dealing with here. If you don't understand that, well, there's no possible way of changing things. Now let's jump to the Philippines with ISIS in the Philippines. Well, you see, there's a lot of Islamic countries not too far from the Philippines. And as the population of Islam grows in the Philippines, the problems will grow. Same way will be here. It's not just, oh, they're nice people, and they're not going to disobey any laws, there's not going to be any guerrilla warfare from these people, Islamists in the United States. If you believe that, I got a Brooklyn Bridge to sell you. As more and more people of a race move into an area, a race or religion, they're going to strike out for power. It's just the way it is, no matter who it is. So, I look for them to hit places like Las Vegas, gambling places in this country. I think you're going to see that. I don't know whether they would hit the Indian casinos or not, but I think for sure they would target Las Vegas and the gambling casinos there and on the East Coast, New Jersey and so forth, and Florida and all that. So just keep your eyes open. Keep your eyes open. If you go to these places, you better watch your ass. Well, let's see what the Jews say. Now that Donald Trump's first presidential overseas trip is behind us, Jewish conservatives and Republican pro-Israel enthusiasts are going to have some explaining to do. Just weeks ago, the pro-Israel right was celebrating the Trump presidency in near messianic terms. Under the new administration, the U.S.-Israel tensions of Obama era were going to vanish. Washington would stand solidly behind the Netwet government. Pressure for dramatic Israel concessions to the Palestinians would cease. Screw those Palestinians. The U.S. Embassy would at last be moved to Jerusalem. Oh, another thing, you know, the reason Israel hates Iran so much, Iran is funding Hamas, which is the government in the Palestinian government, I think, on the West Bank. So that's why they hate those people so much, Iran. Anyhow, continuing, but that wasn't the message Trump brought to Israel. On the contrary, American ambiguity on the status of Jerusalem isn't changing anytime soon. The Palestinians under Mahmoud Abbas are ready to talk peace, the president maintains, snatching away a central pillar of Netwet's diplomatic strategy. What's more, Trump wants to see flexibility from both sides. That includes reining in the Israeli construction of the West Bank settlements, as Trump told Netwet at the White House in February. The result is an insipid crisis mood in circles around the Prime Minister Netwet. He's been trying since Trump's visit to withstand the two opposing forces bearing down on him. On one hand, as Secretary of State Rex Tillerson affirmed in Rome on May 24th, just before he and Trump left Jerusalem, the president is putting a lot of pressure on both Israel and the Palestinians to restart peace talks. Netwet insisted Abbas, who's refusing to return to the table. Trump no longer believes that. On the other hand, there's a widespread feeling among Netwet's ministers and coalition lawmakers that his firebrand right-wing justice minister, Aliat Shekhid, told a radio interviewer on May 26 the prime minister failed to tell Trump the truth, namely that Israel will never leave the West Bank and there will not be a Palestinian state. But bluntly, Netwet faces huge pressure from the American president to show greater flexibility and equal pressure from the right flank of his coalition to do nothing of the sort. How bad is it? The prime minister himself scolded his Likud Knesset caucus on May 29th, and while Israel is a sovereign state and can expect considerable understanding of its positions from Washington, it doesn't have a blank check. Wow. The conventional wisdom surrounding Trump's five-nation tour holds that it amounted in effect to two distinctly separate trips. The first was to Saudi Arabia and Israel, two of America's closest allies in the Middle East, both of which treated him in an elaborate royal welcome. In other words, they kissed his ass. The second was to Belgium, Sicily, and the Vatican, where the Trump held a series of chilly, borderline hostile meetings with Pope Francis, the heads of the NATO alliance, and leaders of the G7 industrialized nations. The contrast couldn't have been more stark between the reception given to Trump in Saudi Arabia and Israel, replete with fanfare, colorful ceremonies, and televised presidential addresses to the host nations, and the stained exchanges between the American president and the America's traditional European allies at NATO G7. Very interesting. There's more, but that slipped out of Israel. But Merkel, nowhere were the tensions voiced more succinctly than in a speech directed from the mouth of the leader of the free world. Free world. Meaning, of course, German Chancellor Angela Merkel, who is born and raised in communist East Germany, which may give you a little clue about where she's coming from, at a political rally in Munich immediately after Trump returned home. Merkel appears to be stepping forward to lead what's left of the traditional Atlantic alliance, and by extension the Democratic West, in the wake of Trump's blatant and abdication of the century-old American mission. The times in which we could totally rely on others are to some extent over, as I experienced the past 2 days, Merkel said. This, at the same time, for, 75, 80 years, they've been sucking on the tit of our military, vast amounts of military in Germany, and actually an occupation force. What's she talking about, that lying bitch? And that, in a nutshell, is the difference between Merkel's Trump problem and Nitwit's problem. Merkel and Europe plus Canada can't get something from Washington that they've long relied on. Military, financial, and moral leadership, and they'll have to try to act on their own and quit sucking off the tit of the American taxpayer. Nitwit, on the other hand, is getting something from Washington that he doesn't want, pressure to compromise, and he's realizing not in a position to act on his own. Merkel and Europe find themselves abandoned and leaderless in an open field, and they have to learn to fend for themselves. Nitwit finds himself squeezed into the corner, and it's not clear what he can do about it. His dilemma particularly difficult because he just got the American president he hoped for, the un-Obama, who is thought to would ease on the pressure and give him a free rein. He's found out instead he didn't know what he was talking about. Probably Israel will start looking for some other tit to suck off of. Maybe China. I don't know about Russia, but China's a prospect. They got plenty of dough. Well, that's about it for today, boys and girls. Thursday. We'll be back with you tomorrow on Freya's Day, Ladies' Day in the bunker, and we'll go from there. Don't let anybody kid you that they can bring thousands and thousands and tens of thousands of Islamic people into this country, and it will not result in guerrilla warfare by Shia types. It's going to happen.
Every piece of this is man's bullshit. They call this war a cloud over the land, but they made the weather, and then they stand in the rain and say, shit, it's raining!